Monarchy is by definition incompatible with democracy. You cannot have a government chosen by election and at the same time have individuals occupying positions of power simply because they were born the sons or daughters of families who already have political power. It was on this principle that the English people fought a civil war, made a revolution, and cut off their king's head in the 17th century. When, after 10 years of being one of the first republics in the world, a monarch was restored to the British throne, it came to be understood that no king or queen would ever seek to rule without Parliament. Indeed, as Britain became a democracy, supporters of the parliamentary system insisted that the British monarchy has no real political power. The Victorian political theorist Walter Bagehot, for instance, wrote that the monarchy was merely a decorative part of the constitution and that real power was exercised by the cabinet. But even now, in the 21st century, is this really true? The royal family is, apart from anything else and beyond dispute, very wealthy, and money is one sort of power. And we pay for the royal family to remain wealthy. Their cost to the taxpayer has been estimated to anywhere between £40 million and £200 million. More than this, recent reports have revealed how much the royal family routinely seeks to directly and personally change the decisions of government. Here we look at how the hereditary power of the royal family still has an impact on the course of British political life. The oldest form of wealth in Britain is landed wealth. Long before there were corporations and banks, indeed long before there was a stable currency, wealth and power were measured by how much land you and your family owned. In medieval Britain, those who owned little or no land were forced to work for those who owned a lot of land. The National Trust and the Forestry Commission are now some of the biggest landowners. But astoundingly, in 21st century Britain, some of the largest landowners are the same as they have been for hundreds of years. The royal family and aristocracy, the Church of England, and Oxford University.
The largest landowners in Britain is the Crown Estate. They own a combined property portfolio of around £8.1 billion. That includes agricultural land as well as urban properties. And this isn't the monarch's personal private land, but she receives an annual percentage revenue from this every year.
Well, the thing about the monarchy is that there are two kinds of ownership. There's the technical ownership, the ownership of 6.6 billion acres of land, i.e. the land that ordinary people around the world in their millions are standing on, living on, working on, farming on, and all the rest of it. And then you can get down to beyond the sort of the abstract and the deeds and so on. You can actually look at the actual physical wealth, concrete land that's owned in this country, in this country alone. Of the 36,000 landowners who own half the wealth in the country, now 36,000 might sound like a lot, but it's 0.6%, it's less than 1% of the UK population own half of the land. Of the top 10 of these 36,000 people, so the top 10 of those, Prince Charles is the third biggest landowner in this country.
The Crown and another 26 aristocratic estates own a total of nearly 1.4 million acres of land, over twice the entire land area owned by the National Trust, and nearly three times the total land owned by the pension funds in the UK. So the land owned by the Crown and aristocracy covers an area over three times the size of Greater London, or as third as much again as the total area of Cornwall. The Crown controls more than half of the UK's shoreline. Crown land is treated as a state asset, not to be sold by the monarch, and its revenues come to the state, and the Queen is paid a percentage of these profits. But the Queen can and does also own private property as a private individual in addition to Crown land.
There's a lot of huge estates which are still owned by members of the British aristocracy, including, of course, the royal family. There are also these peculiar feudal fiefdoms, which in a sense they are, the Duchy of Lancaster and the Duchy of Cornwall, both of which are large royal estates. The finances of the royal family are very complex. There's a whole series of different revenue streams, and of course much of it is shrouded in secrecy. But there are two basic sources of their wealth. One is that they receive direct grants from the state to fund their official functions and big expense accounts as well. And then they have their own private property holdings, some of which is property which belongs to the Crown, some of which is the private property of members of the Windsor family. Balmoral Castle and estate and Sandringham Castle and estate, for example, are both the private property of the Queen as an individual, that is, the private property, if you like, of Elizabeth Windsor, rather than belonging to the Crown. But it's all terribly complicated, and people are left guessing at the actual wealth of the Queen. One estimate, I think, is that it's about £350 million, her private wealth. But it is an estimate because so much of this is shrouded in secrecy.
Crown land is some of the most valuable in the country. Indeed, the value of the Crown's urban property, £4 billion, is four times greater than the value of its rural land holdings. The Crown owns, for instance, the entirety of Regent Street, around half of St James's in London's West End, and retail property across the UK, including in Oxford, Exeter, Nottingham, Newcastle and Harlow. The Crown owns part of the Bluewater retail park in Kent. It also owns retail parks in Leeds, Milton Keynes, Merseyside, Slough, Swansea, Portsmouth, Harlow, Maidstone, Hemel Hempstead, Nottingham, Edinburgh, Warwick, Cheltenham and Jersey. The Windsor Estate controls Ascot Racecourse, golf clubs, hotels, farms and woodland. In Scotland, the Crown owns fishing rights on many rivers, oyster and mussel fishing revenues and mining rights throughout its holdings.
One of the problems with assessing the power of the royal family is that there is no constitution, there is no closely defined set of powers which members of the royal family retain. It's much more a kind of influence behind the scenes, which is quite difficult to measure.
The feudal Cornwall laws allow the Prince of Wales to claim the money and assets of anyone in Cornwall who dies without making a will. If they owe no money, the Prince of Wales can claim that for himself. He doesn't use it to put in his pocket, his back pocket, but he does use it to fund his own personal projects, his own personal charities, and to fund bursaries in private schools. We know that so far he's claimed £3.3 million of other people's money. People have complained about this. The people in Cornwall have asked him to keep the money within the county and at the very least use it for the public spending and the public purse. He's refused to do so and ignores their requests.
In all, the £800 million Duchy of Cornwall estate provides Charles with £19 million worth a year in private profit. The royal family's whole property portfolio is estimated at over £7 billion, earning a tax-free £230 million in profit every single year. And that's before £10 billion worth of art collection is taken into account. With wealth comes power, specifically the power not to obey the laws of the land in the way that every other citizen of the country is required to do. The Prince of Wales Duchy of Cornwall is not, for instance, subject to planning permission or planning consent in the way that any other builder would be. This means that Charles can avoid fines of up to £50,000 that would be levied against anyone else breaking these planning laws. Every other landlord has to grant squatters' rights if they occupy land for 10 years. But for the Prince, that time limit is 60 years. Normally, landlords must allow their leaseholders to buy the freehold on a property. But not the Prince, who can hold leaseholders in that condition forever. The duchy only pays tax voluntarily and has free advice from government lawyers. It also benefits from exemptions that no other private sector body enjoys. For instance, Charles pays no corporation tax or capital gains tax on his business enterprises.
The feudal Cornwall laws are pretty much an archaic and medieval-like remnant from kings and queens past. It allows the Duchy of Cornwall, that's the Prince of Wales' personal estate, to work as a separate legal jurisdiction. So that means that the Prince of Wales cannot be summoned in any of Her Majesty's courts. It means that he cannot be legally summoned to pay tax. And it means he's able to veto any law passed by government which may affect his private interests. And we know he has done this 12 times already.
Prince Charles has private commercial interests. If you take away this magic that is the royalty thing, if you take away the fact that he drives around in a big sparkly pram a lot of the time, if you take away that, he's a normal businessman with commercial interests. And I think it's right in a democracy that we should be able to see which commercial interests are trying to sway government policy.
Charles has long sought to influence many aspects of government policy. His letters to ministers had been kept secret by the Attorney General.
There are the sort of general privileges of the monarchy and the specific ones. The general privileges of the monarchy are pretty mind-boggling, really. Pretty much legal immunity across the board. I mean, there's been various sort of wranglings to make it possible to bring certain kinds of legal proceedings against the royal family, but it's pretty much de facto impossible. And then, of course, there's the kind of specific privileges they have, which is we've seen with the black spider, the so-called black spider memos. When you look at what the scale of these letters, it is quite worrying.
For a long time, there were suspicions that there have been suspicions that Prince Charles writes a lot of letters to ministers and other people, actually, advocating his, you know, his opinions and putting forward ideas on how the government should do things and, you know, how things should be changed. And these have gained the sort of the nickname Black Spider Memos because he's meant to go and write them late at night in his handwriting, which is quite scrawly. 10 years ago, 2005, the editor of The Guardian approached me and asked if we could use the Freedom of Information Act, which had just come into force then, to try and find out what letters Prince Charles had written to ministers and what they've said and what their response had been. So we pursued it from then.
The government attempted to keep the letters secret in the face of a legal challenge from the Guardian newspaper. But recently, the courts ruled that the government had been wrong to prevent the publication of the Prince's attempts to influence government. When the Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, in the last government, sought to veto the publication of the Prince's letters, he did so, he claimed, because they would be seriously damaging to his role as a future monarch. If he forfeits his position of political neutrality as heir to the throne, he cannot easily recover it when he is king.
Prince Charles writing letters to government ministers is quite clearly able to get a hearing, quite clearly is able to influence policy. Some of the responses from government ministers which have come out have been quite sickeningly obsequious. A clear fawning by Labour ministers, in some cases, on leading members of the aristocracy, as if Prince Charles has some right over other citizens to interfere in the political process.
These letters were extremely rambling. They were very long and drawn out. He talks about so many things, all his kind of bugbears and his pet projects, everything from Irish jails to beef farming, to herbal remedies, to military supplies. There's pretty much nothing left that he hasn't got to talk about. Government ministers were very keen and quick to respond to Prince Charles. Tony Blair became a bit of a pen pal of Prince Charles. And I think the Home Secretary of the time, Charles Clarke, he used to sign off these letters from your humble and obedient servant. So it just shows that the level of sycophancy and fawning that was these letters were treated with.
Charles has been writing these letters to ministers since Harold Wilson was Prime Minister in 1969. Charles wrote to ministers in Tony Blair's government no less than 27 times in just 8 months between September 2004 and April 2005.
eventually we got the letters after 10 years. Now, ironically, the letters that actually were released were all typed, so we didn't see much of his scrawly handwriting. It took so long because the government resisted at every point disclosing the document, the letters. They fought first of all in a Freedom of Information Tribunal, which ruled against them. When they lost there, then they decided to veto, use a veto, which blocked the publication, which overruled the court, the tribunal, and blocked the publication of the letters. So we had to then challenge that. And eventually that particular battle went all the way up to the Supreme Court this year, where the government again lost. So after that, there was no other legal avenue that they could pursue to try and stop the letters being published.
The previous Tory Lib Dem coalition spent hundreds of thousands of pounds of taxpayers' money blocking the Guardian newspaper's Freedom of Information request to see and publish the letters before the courts forced the government to back down.
What happened is that because the government were prepared to spend a lot of effort to keep the letters secret, they hired barristers to fight the legal battle at every turn, but they lost. But ultimately, all that legal bill for that is more than £400,000 that the government has spent of taxpayers' money to stop the letters being released.
The reason is simple. The letters, described by the former Attorney General as particularly frank, have undermined the myth that the monarchy has no direct influence on government policy. They show that one man, simply because of the family he was born into, has an unparalleled access to the highest levels of government, access that is closed to any other citizen.
It's taken 10 years for these letters to come to light. It's 2005 that The Guardian started to put in Freedom of Information requests, and I think it's a very telling period because it was coming towards the end of Tony Blair's premiership. It was obviously in the wake of the invasion of Iraq. The tensions in British society were at a phenomenally high level, to put it mildly. It also came at the end of a period of sort of nefarious arms dealings with Saudi Arabia that had gone back into the 80s and till 2006. There was tens of billions of worth of arms was provided to Saudi Arabia that the monarchy, Prince Charles in particular, had helped sell. So it was a very tense period, and it brought to question all the kind of influence that happens in British society from the legal system, from the Prime Minister's office, from the monarchy, and so on. And indeed, you can find hidden in a lot of these memos references to the state of military spending, which is obviously close to the heart of the royal family, making, as they do, so much arms trade from it, and also they had a direct interest in the war going well, which of course it famously didn't.
Eventually, the letters were published, and they were letters over quite a short period of time, just eight months. The suspicion is that he has been writing for years and years. So we had a little snapshot. The public got a small snapshot of what he had been up to. And what they showed is that he had indeed been lobbying at the highest level, putting forward his point of view on particular subjects, wide-ranging number of subjects, and that he was lobbying ministers and even the Prime Minister.
The Guardian's actions in pursuing this story are practically unique in the history of British media. Usually the monarchy can rely on the British press to keep silent on any embarrassing story about the monarchy.
The royal family have a huge amount of influence over the press. They're extremely well connected, and the press pretty much acts as a universal cheerleader for the royal family. I think it was during the Jubilee that the Queen was taking a tour of the BBC studios, and live on air, so-called journalist Julian Warwicker bowed his head live to Her Majesty during the middle of a news report. And this really is unthinkable for a journalist to do. It just shows the level of fawning that we have within the establishment and within the press and within the media. So there's no serious discussion allowed about their constitutional place in society.
In the 1930s, newspapers in Britain remained silent on the relationship between the future King Edward VIII and the American divorcee, Wallace Simpson, the relationship that eventually led to Edward abdicating the throne. And they remained silent even while the news was being reported in the United States.
I think the royal family's influence over the press is considerable and has probably in a way got greater because the British media has become more and more obsequious, I think, over the last 20 to 30 years, much more reluctant to criticise, to expose what is going on inside the British establishment. Partly where it's state media, because they're worried about politicians restricting their funding. And in the case of the private media, because of the degree to which the newspapers and other media are controlled by top press barons, press lords, who of course are themselves leading members of the establishment and have very right-wing politics.
The tradition continues today. The contract with the BBC to film the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton stipulated that the footage could not be used for humorous or satirical purposes. Australian comedy programme The Chaser had to be pulled from the schedules because it breached that ban. During the making of a BBC One programme about the Commonwealth and the Queen's Silver Jubilee, a BBC producer said that it would not be suitable to interview Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard because she is pro-Republican and would not fit the film's positive angle.
In 2011, BBC correspondent Frank Gardner was live on air and he dropped something about the Queen. He said that the Queen was personally distressed about so-called hate preacher Abu Hamza and she was said to be aghast at the fact that he couldn't be arrested for his anti-British values. And they reported on this and then very soon afterwards, Frank Gardner, the BBC and the Director General issued a grovelling apology to the Queen.
Gardner told the BBC's Flagship Today programme. She spoke to the Home Secretary at the time and said, "Surely this man must have broken some laws. Why is he still at large? He was conducting these radical activities and he called Britain a toilet. He was incredibly anti-British and yet he's been sucking up money from this country for a long time. He was a huge embarrassment to Muslims who condemned him." Gardner continued that the Queen, like anybody, was upset that her country and its subjects were being denigrated by this man. But there's the rub. The Queen is not like anybody, because not anyone can call up the Home Secretary and lobby him over matters that they find disturbing. Both the Palace, which refused to comment on the story, and the BBC instantly realised that they had revealed the still existing political power of the monarchy, a power that it is not supposed to have. As a matter of fact, the monarch does not need to make a special effort to get the government to hear her views.
The Queen is legally entitled to meet the Prime Minister once a week. If she can't meet him in person, she's allowed a telephone conversation. During these meetings, she's allowed to discuss anything she wishes, any matter at all. However, whatever she does discuss is kept completely confidential from the rest of the public. We do not have a right to know what she discusses on her behalf.
Tony Blair went further than most in his memoirs when he revealed that his first meeting with the Queen, she acted with hauteur, telling him, "You are my 10th Prime Minister. The first was Winston. That was before you were born." It's a telling few sentences. Clearly for the Queen, elected Prime Ministers come and go, but the monarchy is always there. BAE Systems, Britain's leading arms manufacturer, recently sold 72 Typhoon fighter jets to the Saudi Arabian dictatorship. The original offer from the Saudis was £4.4 billion. But when the deal was done, Ian King, BAE's chief executive, said the public was never going to know how much money the company was eventually paid. But one thing we do know is that on the very eve of the day that the deal was signed, Prince Charles was one of the Saudis' guests in the capital, Riyadh, dressed in the traditional robes and joining the Saudi princes in a sword dance.
Well, the deal with Saudi Arabia was for 72 Eurofighter jets, which are made by BAE Systems. And the deal was worth $4.4 billion to BAE Systems, and funnily enough was signed the day before their otherwise disappointing results for 2013 were released, and while Prince Charles was in Saudi Arabia wining and dining with the heads of the regime who they were pursuing to get the final cost. I'd make the point that David Cameron had visited Saudi Arabia himself in November last year trying to cement this deal, and David Cameron had failed to do it. So it looks an awful lot like Prince Charles went over and did BAE's dirty work for them.
Prince Charles has been, by his own admission, a kind of mascot for the British arms trade, so much so that even he has complained about being used to market weapons in his perhaps more sober moments. But this is still a man who, this is his job, and you can see here where there is, it's a job that's been done, there's a role that the royal family always carry out, regardless of, you know, whether they have a sort of momentary crisis of conscience or whatever. But it remains the case that up until very recent years and months, the royal family, and Prince Charles in particular, have been responsible for closing very big arms deals, particularly with Saudi Arabia. This is another monarchy which can probably does actually beat the royal family in terms of its just reactionary nature. This is a regime that regularly decapitates people for adultery and witchcraft and drug use and anything you can name, really. So this is a thoroughly reactionary and state, and one that has committed crimes against humanity that the British monarchy have rubber stamped these kinds of sales.
The palace denied that the princes, Saudi and British, discussed the arms deal.
One of the key questions is, why do the Saudi Arabian government or the Bahraini regime or any others want to have Prince Charles or Prince Andrew go over to their country and shake hands and greet and be taken around tourist sites? And the reason is because it gives them legitimacy. It gives a British endorsement. What it says is that not just is the United Kingdom prepared to do business with you, we are prepared to send over one of the heads of state to go over and do our bidding. And what it says is that Prince Charles is being used by BAE Systems and is being used as an arms dealer.
A previous investigation into UK-Saudi arms deals, Margaret Thatcher's sale of Tornado aircraft in the Al Yamama deal, was blocked by Tony Blair on national security grounds.
Prince Andrew's done more than his fair share of whining and dining with some of the most repressive regimes and dictators in the world. Earlier this year, Prince Andrew was in Bahrain as part of Great British Week, where he went over with some of the great British companies like BAE Systems and other arms companies, Rolls-Royce, who were there specifically to sell weapons and to make deals with some of the most repressive governments in the world.
There is a direct relationship between what the royal family are doing in relation to arms sales and in relation to imperial wars, let it be said, because of course members of the royal family serve in the armed forces, and by serving in the armed forces, Harry in Afghanistan, for example, what they do is they put a kind of gloss on those kinds of imperial interventions. So the royal family is involved in the imperialist wars in that sense, is giving its blessing to those imperialist wars, and selling arms to Saudi Arabia is selling arms to an extremely reactionary monarchy with an appalling human rights record, an appalling record on civil liberties, which is also using its military power, projecting its military power elsewhere to suppress revolutionary movements in Bahrain 2 or 3 years ago and currently in Yemen.
Former South African MP Andrew Feinstein resigned in protest over BAE bribery allegations. He has his own experience of the royal family's arms interests.
We try to investigate a huge and very corrupt arms deal. BAE won the contract in very controversial circumstances. The plane that the Air Force wanted was 2.5 times less expensive than the BAE offering and was far more suited to South Africa's needs. But The Metropolitan Police have estimated that £115 million in bribes were paid on that one deal alone. And unfortunately, the British royal family were intimately involved, together with Tony Blair, the then Prime Minister, in persuading the new South African government to buy these trainers and jet fighters, to the extent that the then Royal Yacht Britannia was sailed to Cape Town Harbour with some members of the royal family aboard, and they invited to dinner those ministers who were going to make the crucial decision about BAE Systems.
Strangely, perhaps, a Buckingham Palace spokesman who spoke to The Guardian had much the same view, with an added tinge of colonial snobbery. Middle East potentates like meeting princes. He comes in as the son of the Queen, and that opens doors that otherwise would remain closed. He can raise problems with the Crown Prince, and 4 or 5 weeks later, we discover that the difficulties have been overcome and the contract can be signed. He brings an immeasurable value in smoothing the path for British companies. We don't send him to developed countries like France and Sweden, where a member of the royal family would not make a difference. But in developing countries or the Far East, a prince can get in because of who he is.
One of the characteristics of British capitalism, the British economy in recent times, really I suppose since the Second World War, has been that the arms industry has played a very important role in the British economy and in British trade. The British are very keen to sell top-of-the-range weapons technology. Very often the market is dictators, particularly dictators in the Middle East and North Africa. And if you want to establish diplomatic relations and trading relations with feudal or semi-feudal regimes in the Middle East and North Africa, it helps if you've got your own royals who can operate at that social level, who can give you an entree. So Prince Charles has played a major role, Prince Andrew has played a major role, other royals, I'm sure, as well, have played a role in developing these diplomatic relations and helping arms manufacturers to sell weapons to Middle Eastern dictators.
Unlike the case of Prince Andrew, when there have been other members of royal families in other parts of the world who have got involved, for instance, in the arms trade and behaved inappropriately, they suffer consequences. For instance, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands at one point was promoting arms sales into the Netherlands and was working with two American companies to do so. Neither of the companies realized he was working for the other, and his wife, the Queen of the Netherlands, didn't know he was working for either of them. When it was discovered that he was engaged in this activity, he was stripped of all sorts of rights and privileges, and he was never allowed to wear the uniform of the Dutch military ever again. Now, having a royal family is not ideal, but if one has one for whatever historical reasons, at least make them accountable and answerable for their actions. Whereas in this country, they can effectively do as they like.
But Andrew's particular form of charm worked as well on dictators, whether or not they were of the royal variety. He is reported to have had a close friendship with Saif Gaddafi, son of Colonel Gaddafi, and hosted a lunch at Buckingham Palace for the son-in-law of Tunisian dictator Ben Ali, despite being warned of his corrupt activities by the British Embassy in Tunis. As for the Saudi government, the biggest market for UK arms companies, they are now using those arms in an unprovoked attack on neighbouring Yemen. In the world of international diplomacy, it is usual to distinguish between a nation's hard power and its soft power. The hard power of the US, for instance, is its military capacity and its economic strength. Its soft power might be the cultural influence of Hollywood, the social influence of its press, or the good feeling felt by millions of children around the globe towards Ronald McDonald or Captain America.
The soft power of the UK is considered to be a persuasive approach using cultural and economic means. whereas the UK hard power would be considered to be military might, aggression, war or policing.
So it is with the British monarchy. Part of its power, as we have seen, is its hard power, the power of wealth, of landed property, of direct political influence. But perhaps it has even greater influence in its exercise of soft power, the ideological and cultural influence that the royal family exerts in British society.
Well, I think in terms of the soft and hard power, so to speak, of the royal family, there are there's a clear backstop to everything that happens in British democratic life. They do sanction any political party that comes into power. In fact, in the 1970s, they overturned the election of a progressive prime minister in Australia because it was went so far against the interests of the royal family. So they actually do have the power to overturn governments. These things are very rarely used because partly because to do that does actually draw into public awareness the actual power the monarchy has. Like the Black Spider memos, we're told that actually no, they were just a kind of, you know, they're just the icing on the cake. They're just a kind of tourist attraction. They're just, you know, symbolic figureheads and so on. But actually, with the Black Spider memos, you find out no, they're actually interfering in daily life on a regular basis. Around the Scottish independence campaign, you see that they're actually interfering in the democratic processes going on inside Britain. So there's always the kind of a dance between their soft and their hard power. So when they use it, when they bring out the big guns, they actually expose themselves. So they're very careful. The British ruling class is very careful about how they, where they step in and where they don't step in.
It's very difficult to actually tell what power and influence the monarchy has over this government because it's so secret. It's like the rest of the corporate lobbying industry in this country is all done behind closed doors, or as David Cameron likes to say, it's a quiet word. You know, we don't know who's speaking to whom, we don't know who's having a quiet word with whom about which policies. So I see it as actually the tip of a very large iceberg. We have a £2 billion industry that we know nothing about, and the royalty are part of that. I mean, they're exceptional because they have this kind of magic sheen around them, which is the pomp and the costumes and the dressing up that they do. And so we don't sort of question their influence as much as we should. But we should look at really who out of everybody. I mean, we should look at the whole industry. And they are lobbyists. They have private commercial interests.
The royal family is quite deliberately used by the British establishment as a traditional symbol of the hierarchical and elitist society as a whole.
The media collaborates in the cover-up. It collaborates in massaging the news in order to downplay anything which is critical of the royal family. And what it also does is it pumps up all of the kind of bread and circuses nonsense, the Hello magazine-type celebrity culture which surrounds them. So there's a royal wedding or there's a royal baby or whatever, and they turn it into a jamboree, which is like something out of ancient Rome or something out of medieval England. A completely kind of feudal sort of obsession with these extraordinarily rich.
After all, if people in Britain can be got to accept one incredibly wealthy individual whose position as nominal head of state and church and chief of the armed forces is hereditary, then why should they not accept an entire ruling elite based on similarly undemocratic principles? The existence of the monarchy is based on the idea of perpetual inequality as a natural order. It bolsters the old adages that seek to ensure that the status quo remains undisturbed. This is the world where the poor are always with us, where there will always be the rich man in his castle and the poor man at his gate.
If the purpose of the monarchy is as a tourist attraction, we should do two things. We should add a small levy onto the taxes and fees the tourists pay to come into the UK anyway. And that's how we could fund the British monarchy, rather than it being funded through hard-earned taxpayers' pounds and pence. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if what they're meant to be is a tourist attraction, then they should stay well out of any public debates, that constitutionally they shouldn't be involved in any way. So Prince Andrew should not be rushing around the world like a buffoon, selling British weapons to highly inappropriate governments. Prince Charles should not be writing letters to people in decision-making positions to try and ensure that his vision of what the United Kingdom should look like architecturally is imposed on the country. Then they can be just a tourist attraction. Then I would have less of a problem with them. But as long as we are paying for their extremely luxurious lifestyle, I think we also have a right to determine what they do and don't do.
This is a world where the poor and disadvantaged are supposed to find solace in gazing on the finery of the royals, where everything from the crown jewels to Kate Middleton's wedding dress is supposed to bring glamour to lives where even small luxuries cost a week's wages. The majority of the press encourage us to forget our own troubles and worry about the happiness or otherwise of the characters in the royal soap opera. William and Kate's happy marriage, Diana and Charles's unhappy marriage, are talked about as if they matter more than the trials and joys of our own friends and relatives.
They have a very sophisticated PR machine. They are a brand that needs to be looked after, and they engage in any other practices that any other entity, brand, engages in. So any bad stories they will seek to quash and keep out of the media, and they will pump it full of good stories.
The unacceptable racist ramblings of the Duke of Edinburgh are suppressed. The unfortunate nonsense let slip by Prince Andrew is excused. The less appealing members of the family, like Fergie, are hidden from view or expelled from the clan.
And it is worth remembering that this is not a family who've exactly covered themselves in glory by the way they've behaved. I mean, Prince Andrew's father, the Duke of Edinburgh, has on numerous occasions been overheard making quite racist comments, highly inappropriate comments. I mean, one of the younger members of the royal family, Prince Harry, found it amusing to dress up in a Nazi uniform for a fancy dress party.
Every charitable gesture or good work, on the other hand, is magnified. It is the work of PR experts, spin doctors, and the loyal royal correspondents. But it is a national myth, and only partly believed.
The royal family is of course, packaged as a family of people who are doing all sorts of good works, who are raising money for charity and that kind of thing. And of course, that's all part of the packaging. It's a necessary part of the packaging. The reality is quite different. The reality is that they are a central institution in a very conservative and traditional political order. But they are also, despite the fact they are in a sense a leftover from feudalism, they're also doing the business of modern British capitalism.
The UK would be far better off without a monarchy, just in terms of monetary value. The £45 billion that they're worth could be redistributed to a whole host of good causes, social workers, firefighters, the homeless, etc., etc. In this time of austerity, supposedly there's a 600% rise in food banks. Why doesn't the Queen or the monarchy just distribute one of their palaces, one of their castles to that? There's people going hungry in this country, and I don't see the Queen participating in the austerity movement. And we'd have a more democratic country. We as people would no longer be subjects, we'd be citizens. And finally, just to add one more thing, it's still technically illegal to discuss republicanism as an alternative to monarchy. That's something that needs to be repealed in Parliament immediately if we're to be taken seriously as a democratic country.
Despite the years of pro-royal propaganda, some 30% think the UK would be better off without a monarch. That figure rises to 50% in Scotland. Some 60% are against Prince Charles becoming king when the current Queen dies.
The easiest question to answer is, would the UK be better off without the royal family? Yes, it would. And of course, it wouldn't be the UK. It wouldn't be a united kingdom. It would be a democratic country. In fact, it would be much smaller in an ideal world. It wouldn't encroach into any of the landmass of Ireland. It wouldn't encroach even into Scotland. That's clearly said. Over 50% now actually want to separate. Most people over 60% admit it's inevitable that there will be a separation. This can only be a good thing because this this sort of bundle of different small countries in a small part of the European landmass, or just off the European landmass, have had exponential, disproportionate and destructive range over the entire planet for centuries, and I think for that to come to an end can only be a good thing, really.
There is no question at all that Britain would be a much healthier place without the monarchy. But the monarchy is only one of a number of antiquated institutions which are barriers to real democracy. The House of Lords is another. Our dysfunctional electoral system, our first-past-the-post system, is a third, and there are many others that one could think of. The British political system needs a radical overhaul, even to create a modern parliamentary democracy, and we need to see very, very radical changes indeed in the way in which we make decisions if the interests of ordinary people are going to be reflected going forwards.
There is likely to be a crisis of confidence, if not a constitutional crisis, when the Queen is succeeded by Charles. It will be a moment when ordinary citizens in the UK have to examine whether an hereditary, hugely wealthy, unconstitutionally influential, politically reactionary institution is still the best adornment for a supposedly democratic society in the 21st century.